Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As you well know, we love to do history programs on this show. As a matter of fact, we go beyond the show and we've gone to Springfield, we've gone to Washington and Gettysburg with listeners. This hour, we'll be looking at probably a war that we don't know very much about, the War of 1812. We're in the bicentennial of that war, and the author of Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple and the Second War of Independence, will be joining us momentarily. Hugh Howard will join us, and we'll learn a whole lot about the War of 1812. This is, though, also our spring membership drive. Rhonda Fanning is joining me in our studios here in Milwaukee. Today we are asking you to put something back in Wisconsin Public Radio. We count on listener contributions to pay for just about everything that we do. And your gift keeps the programs that you value, including this one, on the air. WPR.org, the place to go, or 888-202-2552. Hey, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. Last hour, the goal was 45 pledges, and we heard from 24 listeners last hour. So thank you for those pledges. This hour, we have a goal of 40 pledges. Those hourly goals are extremely important. They help us stay on track financially so we can keep the discussion going strong on Wisconsin Public Radio. So please take a moment right now and give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Just think about all of the issues that you hear discussed every day, to say nothing of the past few months on the Ideas Network. What about the past year? There are so many, and all the conversations were possible because of listener support. Please make your pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Do it for all that you have learned so much in the past year on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And a pledge of $180 this hour, you will get a copy of Hugh Howard's book, Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple and the Second War of Independence.
You're going to learn so much about the War of 1812 and about the Madisons. I think that John Kennedy at one point said he was one of America's most underrated presidents, and certainly Dolly was a piece of work. She was just incredible. She was beautiful through fabulous parties. She was really smart. And they were a power couple in Washington. So the book is a lot about her as well. And Hugh Howard will be joining us momentarily to talk about James and Dolly Madison and the War of 1812. Please give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you'll enjoy a WPR pledge-free after 1 o'clock this afternoon. But to make pledge-free afternoons possible, we need to pull together during these morning hours. So your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 helps keep this pledge drive efficient. So thank you in advance to everyone who's already pledged this morning. And if you haven't already, please go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you so much, Rhonda, for all that you do. Thanks for all the history programs that we do as well. I just love them, and I know that many of our listeners do as well. This hour of the program, we are going to be speaking with Hugh Howard. Hugh is the author of Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple and the Second War of Independence. This, of course, is the bicentennial of the War of 1812, and our guest writes in the intro to the book that it stands as perhaps the least understood of America's war. His purpose is not to shape parable or to teach a lesson, but to offer a view of events at first hand, being a reconstruction based on primary sources, including countless letters, journals, ledgers, newspaper reports, government records, memoirs, and other documents. He is with us right now, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. What we do know about the war is it gave us our national anthem, and it is something that we need to understand better, and we will by the end of this conversation. Hugh, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here, Kathleen. Thank you.
Yeah, it was great. It's great I'm glad that you wrote this, because I think it is true that we just don't, and it was such a significant event, we don't understand this war very well at all. Why is that? Why have we neglected it?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons, but maybe the largest is the simple fact that we didn't win. That isn't to say we lost, But I think we, as Americans, like to think of ourselves as winners. And this was a war where it really ended when the British kind of packed up and went home.
It also, we remember that the White House was burned down, and that's one of the more dramatic parts of this book because the occupants, and Dolly in particular, had taken such care of, you describe beautifully what she did to each room and all of the valuables that were there and the history was that was there, and it just made you weep to read about setting torch to it.
Well, you know, my writing tends to be place-specific. You know, I've written about the architectural past, and that led me to write about Jefferson, and it's led me to write about Washington. And, in fact, in some degree, it's true that I started this book because I was fascinated by the White House, by what was done to it, by the architect Benjamin Latrobe, and the collaboration that Dolly Madison, as the lady presidentess, as she was known, had with the, perhaps the best architect in America at that time.
Mm-hmm. You, early in the book, talk about John Kennedy's comments about James Madison. He was such an accomplished man, such a smart man, so instrumental in the drawing of the Constitution. I think it's probably true what Kennedy said, and you quote him, is he is an underrated president. Why is he underrated?
Well, I think the War of 1812 is part of that. Again, people don't remember it with the same degree of vividness that they remember the Civil War or the wars of the 20th century or even the Revolution. But part of it is also that he had other days in his life for which he is remembered very vividly, the Constitution being one, his early days in Congress as Washington's point man when he managed to engineer the passage of the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm. You start the book with the British ambassador feeling that something was about to happen. Tell us about the beginning of the book and what made the British ambassador think something was up.
Well, Madison, unbeknownst to the ambassador, Augustus John Foster, had dispatched the piece of paper down Pennsylvania Avenue, which was in fact a declaration of war, and he was looking for Congress's approval. But Congress went behind closed doors to debate this very difficult issue. Congress was in no sense of one mind about this. The Federalists from Massachusetts and from the North were opposed to going to war. But Augustus John Foster was pretty well connected, and he had a sense that this was in the air, as in fact it had been for 4 or 5 years because of the activities of the British, impressing soldiers, taking American maritime ships, and so on.
And they took a lot of maritime ships. I had no idea how many they had taken.
Yes, something like 1,000.
Wow.
The count isn't precise, but that's a lot. And some 5,000 American sailors, some of them on military ships, but most of them on sailing ships that were just trading ships, were taken right off the decks of those ships and impressed into the Royal Navy.
Mm-hmm. What were they up to? What did they want?
Well, of course, they were at war with France. They had a finite number of men to serve in both the British Army and in the Royal Navy, and so they needed more men. And they were also interested in limiting the amount of trade that America could conduct with their enemy, namely the French. So they were serving their own military and commercial interests as they went about fighting a much bigger war in Europe.
You say that you just mentioned that there wasn't a lot of agreement. There was great dissension about whether or not we should go to war. Part of that, you say, to understand this war, we need to look at where we were in American history, that it was a period of transformation for the early U.S. with the revolutionary generation passing from the scene and something different taking its place.
I think that's very true. We had under the Washington administration, taken an essentially isolationist approach to world politics. And I think we'd become something of a whipping boy of the British. But that had to end at some point, and Madison took a firm position and went to war. I think Henry Clay put it in a kind of interesting way. He was Speaker of the House, a Kentuckian, and a very influential figure in Washington. And he said that going to war was as necessary to America as a duel is to a young officer to prevent his being bullied and elbowed in society. Hmm. So we, you know, kind of in a David and Goliath situation, cast ourselves as David and faced off with Goliath.
But Madison had to be persuaded to go to war. He really wasn't a warrior, was he?
He was not. His previous post, before he was elected president, was as Secretary of State in the Jefferson administration. Jefferson was perhaps his best friend. And they worked very hard to stay out of war. That was a tenet of their political party. But the circumstances accumulated over a period of time. The impressment, the embargo, the British were rabble-rousing amongst the Indians. And they even sent, the British did even sent a spy into Federalist Boston to discover whether there was any possibility that the Union could be divided. So Madison felt he had to act in 1812.
Mm-hmm. How strong was the consideration of secession by Federalists?
Well, that's a subject of debate, and I think it probably wasn't as likely as some on the other side of the political spectrum would have had it, but I think there was great dissatisfaction amongst the Federalists about any notion of going to war, as is exhibited by the fact that when Congress discussed this, they at some point had a vote, and it was and the Federalists voted 39-0 against going to war. So clearly they weren't in favor.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch a moment to, because the book goes so beautifully back and forth between all the preparations for war, deliberations, et cetera, and what Dolly was doing in the White House. That Dolly was something, wasn't she?
Well, I love Dolly. You know, she was,
yeah.
You know, one of the reasons to write this book was that she was such an extraordinary character. She was a little bit sexy. She was a little bit of a babe, and I say that.
Of course, you can.
I say that respectfully, but she was more than a wonderful hostess. Although, as a hostess, she served a very significant political purpose, because James was not the most welcoming man in the world. He was quiet and small and shy. He had a not very loud speaking voice, so he didn't fill a room. But Dolly could. Dolly could not only fill a room, but make everybody feel welcome. In fact, again, I hate to quote Henry Clay again, but he at one point said of her, "Everybody loves Mrs. Madison." And she happened to be standing nearby, and she said, "Well, that's because Mrs. Madison loves everybody."
Da-da-da! What a great line. And she had these events, and I guess everybody came. It was interesting that people of all kinds of political persuasions would show up. Was it Wednesday afternoons from 3 to 5?
That's right. She had what were called drawing rooms, that is to say, open houses where everyone came to her drawing room, although they were quickly nicknamed squeezes because so many people came, they stood shoulder to shoulder, squeezed into a finite amount of space. To tell you the truth, I think that maybe in our own time we could learn something from this, because the Federalists came, the Democrat Republicans came, they shared a little bowl of ice cream or a glass of whiskey or whatever was being served. And with Dolly present, everyone behaved well, and they talked about the issues of the day. And I think there was a kind of camaraderie and we're in this together feeling that, at least when at the White House, was a positive factor in Washington politics.
Tell us who introduced them, James and Dolly.
Well, it was none other than Aaron Burr.
My, my.
He was he lived in a rooming house that Dolly Madison's mother ran. Dolly Madison was a young widow, a quite beautiful young woman with a young son. And Madison, who knew Burr, said, "I'd like to meet her." So Aaron Burr arranged it. And 4 months later, James and Dolly Madison were married in 1794.
And what about the relationship between the two of them? Was she his confidant?
Oh, I think she was. There's not as much correspondence in existence between them as there might be, because they were very rarely separated. However, at one point during the Jefferson administration, Dolly had a medical procedure in Philadelphia. James went with her, stayed as long as he could, but then he had to get back to running the government. So she remained in Philadelphia, and they corresponded. And there are a number of very interesting and, I think, revealing letters, one that comes to mind. She wrote to him and said, of course, I'm not a political person in the first sentence, and I'm paraphrasing loosely here. And then in the second sentence, she said, so what's happening in the cabinet?
And what about the cabinet? Madison had some problems with cabinet members, didn't he, filling posts?
He did. He had some brilliant men. He had James Monroe as his Secretary of State, who obviously subsequently became president and was a man of extraordinary energy and talent. However, he also had a Secretary of War who was really a lot more interested in plotting to become the next president than he was in doing his duty as Secretary of War. And he was, I guess you could say, asleep at the switch when it came time for the British to march on Washington in 1814, which led to the events you alluded to before.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests, and here's how you reach the conversation. He's the author of a wonderful new book. It fills a gap that many of us have in our history knowledge. It's about the War of 1812, and it's about James Madison and the babe, Dolly Madison, Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple, and the Second War of Independence, which has just been published. And Hugh has written a number of other books. He, as you heard him say, is very interested in architecture and architecture of this period. He is the author of The Painter's Chair, George Washington and the Making of American Art, Dr. Kimball and Mr. Jefferson, the definitive Thomas Jefferson architect, his memoir, House Dreams, and the classic House of the Founding Fathers. We are welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For those of you who are building presidential libraries or find that you have a gap in your knowledge of the War of 1812 and want to know more about this fascinating first couple and can afford to give us a pledge of $180, we're very happy to send you this. We do a lot of history on this program, and we love doing history, and it's one of the special things, I think, about what we put together each day. So if you like it as well, this may be a marvelous hour for you to pledge. To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hugh Howard, our guest, author of Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple, and the Second War of Independence. And we start our calls with Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
This is a fascinating topic, and I would like to point out, I'm sure not as any news to your guest, that the War of 1812 largely guaranteed the continued existence of Canada and a French-speaking entity in Canada, pretty much opened the original West to domination by the United States and led to the demise of the Native Americans as independent and significant entities. And there was the remarkable situation where in the Northeast there was a mutual pact of non-aggression between the political entities there, which allowed the British to shift forces to what was then Upper Canada and successfully resist the invasion. And one of the characteristic things, perhaps, that was established in the War of 1812 was that Americans considered staged aggressions as acts of liberation. And, of course, the response in Quebec and Ontario was to shoot back. So, perhaps the guest knows about the March of the 104th. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank, as always.
I think Frank makes some very interesting points. You know, we were talking earlier about who won the war and who lost the war, and there is an argument to be made that the war's biggest winner was, in fact, Canada. Canada, the Canadian soldiers, which were, of course, British citizens at that point, they resisted the American assault very successfully, and to this day, many in Canada think of the War of 1812 as a great military moment in their history. The flip side of that, of course, is the Native American. They were called Indian in those days. Native American didn't really come to be used as a phrase until the 1960s. But for the Indians, It was really the beginning of a really terrible century for them. You know, the 19th century was not a happy time for Native Americans. And during the War of 1812, they lost a couple of very significant battles, the Battle of Thames in Canada, another battle down in Alabama that led to literally millions of acres being ceded to white settlers, and the loss of maybe their most charismatic leader, Tecumseh, who died at the Battle of Thames in 1813. So, you know, I take Frank's points. They're very interesting ones.
Tell us, please, more about the campaigns that were taking place, Lake Champlain, Lake Erie, the Canadian Front. How many fronts there were here? It was primarily a sea battle, not a land battle, was it? Wasn't it? But there were battles taking place where in the United States?
Well, initially, the American forces invaded Canada. The advice that Madison had been given by, among others, Jefferson. Jefferson said to him that capturing Canada would be a mere matter of marching, which is pretty good alliteration, but proved to be pretty terrible soothsaying. The three campaigns that were launched, one in the Upper Lakes, which is to say the Michigan vicinity, one in the Lower Lakes, which is to say across the lake from up New York State, and then downriver in Lake Champlain, all three of those initial assaults ended in failure in the fall of 1812, the battle at Fort Detroit being a particular debacle. So those fronts continued more or less throughout the war. But, of course, there were also sea battles on the high seas, on the oceans, off the coast of the United States and in the Atlantic and elsewhere. So there were numerous fronts prior to the really significant battles much later in the war, in 1814, that is, in the Chesapeake, and then even into early 1815 at the Battle of New Orleans. So the battles did take place a number of different places.
I had the feeling reading the book that the war was not conducted in a quick manner. It was a war that seemed to go on and on.
Well, it's funny, you know, there are lots of reasons why people don't remember the War of 1812, but I think one of the reasons is that the name itself is a misnomer. This isn't a war that took place in 1812. For one thing, it didn't start until 6 months into the year, and then it lasted for 32 months. So it was really the War of 1812, 13, 14, and a little bit of 15.
Yeah.
Which made it all the longer and all the more complicated to kind of fit into our historic memories.
Sarah joining us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, hi. I happened to read a novel recently that was about the Napoleonic Wars and the War of 1812, and it was by a British author, and she said that, well, in the novel, the generals who went to fight the War of 1812, you know, weren't the best generals because they were busy with Napoleon. And the guy, the general who torched the White House, that was depicted as being this one general just got totally overexcited, and it wasn't British policy to burn down the White House, and that the rest of the army was embarrassed about it, and the government was angry, the British government. And I just wonder if that's true.
Thank you, Sarah. Good question. Yes, I think to some degree that's true. The principal military decider in the assault on Washington was a man named Alexander Coburn, who happened to be an admiral rather than a general. He was in the Royal Navy. And I think it is certainly true that he exceeded the orders that he had been given. Now, initially, when the word reached London that the British soldiers had burned the American capital, there was some happiness in the streets. You know, the newspapers reported a sense of victory, and the Americans deserved this because there was a sense in Great Britain that the former colonists had really been an obstruction to the British as they went about fighting the French. However, over a period of weeks, it's pretty clear that there was a public backlash as people began to think about the fact that Washington was not a military target. It had no strategic value, really. And so Coburn's excessive assault, the fact that they had set fire to buildings that, again, had no military significance, caused him to be thought of in a rather different light.
I was so struck by Dolly pretty much alone in the White House, packing up her husband's papers, etc. Most of the city had evacuated, and there was Dolly waiting until the last minute to leave.
Yeah, well, she was, I think, had an unerring political instinct, which is of a tremendous advantage to her husband. But in this particular circumstance, she was ready to go. She'd actually received a message from her husband via messenger saying that she should flee because the British were indeed marching on Washington, essentially unopposed, having dispatched with the forces at the Battle of Bladensburg a few miles away. But she refused to leave because she looked up at the wall of her dining room, and there was a life-size portrait of George Washington. Mm-hmm. And undoubtedly, any number of your listeners have heard this story. But in a nutshell, she said, I'm not going anywhere until we move that picture, because to leave that for the British would be to leave them an opportunity for a significant propaganda victory. So she arranged for the picture to be taken off the wall. They had to smash the frame. It was a gilt wooden frame. She got it off the wall and got it loaded into a cart and taken to safety in Maryland so that the British wouldn't get it. In the meantime, it took an extra hour. In the meantime, the British were getting all the closer. So it was a demonstration of her bravery as well as her very sound political instincts.
Oh, you can hear that story every day. It's still the best of stories, isn't it, Hugh? It's a good story.
Indeed.
Yeah. We're going to welcome more phone calls, and I do want to let you know that we are in our spring membership pledge drive right now, too. And for those of you who can pledge $180, you'll remember this conversation forever, and you'll learn a heck of a lot more about the War of 1812, because we'll send you a copy of Hugh Howard's book is a thank you gift, Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple in the Second War of Independence. Joining me now is Rhonda Fanning. Rhonda Fanning is always joining me. Rhonda is here producing shows every day, and a fine job she does. And I'm particularly fond of the history shows that we do. We've done some great programs, haven't we, Rhonda?
Yeah, we learn something new every day.
Isn't that true? That's a way to live.
Lifelong
learning.
That's
a way to live. Yes, ma'am.
This hour, though, we're looking to get 32 more pledges in the next 26 minutes. Your pledge right now helps keep the program going strong. So please make your contribution at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We really think that WPR is a unique radio service, a service well worth your support. Take a moment to voice your opinion right now by making a pledge of support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you're like Kathleen and many of our listeners and love history books, this hour you can receive a copy of Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War when you make a contribution of $180. Your donation not only helps support the programs you love, but you can get this book with your pledge, again, at the $180 or more. So please pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Families often tell us how WPR brings them closer together. I think this is true. Children and parents listen together before school and on the weekends when they're in their teenage years and want to be listening to rock and roll, and you make them listen to NPR, they may complain. But years later, they will talk about those wonderful drives with their mother listening to NPR. I've been there. Spouses get together at the end of the day and discuss the stories they heard. I mean, imagine, because of this, you may talk about the War of 1812 or the Madisons tonight at the dinner table.
I was just
going to
say,
great?
How many dinner time conversations have revolved around, you know, today on WPR?
I know. Ain't that the truth? It's great.
Listening to WPR can be a point of connection between you and your loved ones. And your support right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 keeps that connection going.
You may want to consider making your pledge in the form of an ongoing monthly gift. You can set that up on your credit card or right from your bank account. When you make an ongoing gift, you don't have to remember to renew your support every year.
You'll be a sustaining member, and your support will be consistent as consistent as your WPR listening, month after month, year after year. Become a sustainer now by making an ongoing gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're still looking for 32 more pledges in the next 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And nothing would make us happier than to really meet our goal on the War of 1812. I mean, it really indicates what we do and that it can only be done here. So please pledge now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And be sure that you ask for a copy of Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War with your pledge of 180 or more. Pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thanks to everyone who's already pledged this hour.
Thanks so much, Rhonda. Rhonda Fanning, the extraordinary producer of this program. Our guest this hour is Hugh Howard, author of Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple, and the Second War of Independence. We go back to phone calls and John in Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Hi. I will wonder if your guest could comment on the movie, I think it's 1957 movie, The Buccaneer. How accurate was that portrayed? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
If I've seen the movie, I'd be delighted to comment upon it. Not having done so, I'm afraid I can't.
You will, though, in the future, I guess. I haven't seen it either, so I don't have a clue.
I'll make a point of it.
There can't have been a whole lot of movies about the War of 1812, have there?
Not that I know of. There's a very interesting recent PBS documentary. It certainly comes up kind of in passing in a few places, but it isn't. It doesn't. The War of 1812 doesn't inhabit our historic memory in a way that, as we were saying earlier, so many other wars do. Although it's kind of funny that it doesn't, because there are bits and pieces from the War of 1812 that we recognize as part of our historic past, even if we don't put them in their place. Things like, don't give up the ship, for example.
Right.
That's a famous phrase. It's the motto of the U.S. Navy. And it comes from an event in the War of 1812 where an American captain named James Lawrence, who, having taken a musket ball to his thigh, was being taken beneath decks of his ship. And as he did so, he ordered his sailors, don't give up the ship. In fact, we lost that particular battle. The USS Chesapeake was captured by the HMS Shannon in that sea battle. And yet his words live in our memories. And in fact, as the motto, I think probably every sailor in the United States Navy knows them today.
Right. Except that one in Italy. The other thing is the Star Spangled Banner.
That's right. Of course, another great story. A barrister by the name of Frank Key. We know him as Francis Scott Key today, but his friends know him as Frank. He was a lawyer. He was not exactly imprisoned, but he was being held by the British on a ship in the harbor outside of Baltimore because he'd gone to negotiate the freedom of a prisoner of war and happened to be there at just the wrong time, that is to say when the British were planning to attack Baltimore. So since he was in the presence of the planning, they couldn't let him go because clearly he'd go back and tell his fellow Americans what was happening. So from shipboard, he was watching as the bombardment of Baltimore took place in September of 1814. Now, of course, the Americans prevailed. The British ended up turning tail and heading back out to sea. But he had spent a very long night wondering who would win and whether the American flag would be flying in the morning. There was an enormous 30-foot-long flag at Fort McHenry, which guarded the opening to the harbor at Baltimore. Hmm. And, of course, it was there. He wrote a poem called The Defense of Fort McHenry, which subsequently was put to music and much later became our national anthem.
Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. Now, to me, of course, the big event of the War of 1812 was the Battle of New Orleans, which occurs in 1815. And there you had about 2,000 crack troops who had been fighting Napoleon, helping to defeat Napoleon's effort in Europe. They came and they were totally defeated. by General Jackson in New Orleans, a ragtag army put together at the last moment. Some people I know have said it's kind of the almost a prelude to the trench warfare of World War One. I don't know if that's true, but the Americans lost just a handful of people. The British lost, what, 2,000 or something like that. The British mm-hmm. were totally defeated
yes.
in New Orleans. And I think one of the reasons we don't hear about it anymore is General Jackson is so politically incorrect. He's the one who kicked the Indians out of the South. Mm-hmm. By the way, the Indians had slaves, and many of those Indians fought for the Confederacy during the American Civil War. But because he's politically incorrect, we can't honor the man who defeated the British in New Orleans and so forth. He also, I guess, attacked the early version of the Federal Reserve and went after the U.S. Bank. I think it's in part because the multicult and the liberals who not the old liberals. Schlesinger, of course, compared him to FDR, and he was a great hero. But in the present era of our politically correctness, you can't honor Jackson anymore.
You.
Well, you raised some very interesting points, although I would have to say that to some degree, honoring Andrew Jackson is a regional thing. That is to say, if you go to New Orleans, I think you'll find that they still celebrate that war. If you go to Nashville, I think you'll find that they still celebrate Andrew Jackson as a great hero. So it's a slightly more complicated picture than my namesake Hugh has characterized it. at the same time, I think the Battle of New Orleans is an extraordinarily interesting battle. Not least because it occurred rather out of sequence. It was clearly the biggest land victory of the War of 1812, but it was fought after the Treaty of Ghent had been signed, the treaty that ended the war. Mm. It sounds bizarre, but of course the explanation is that the Treaty of Ghent was signed in Ghent, Belgium, and in order to get the news from Europe to America, a messenger had to get on shipboard, sail to England, get on another ship, sail to New York, get off that ship, get on a stagecoach, travel in that all the way to Washington. And it took almost 2 months for the word to reach Washington, not to mention New Orleans, where it got there a few days thereafter. In the meantime, this significant battle was fought, one at which I think the American army proved itself. Yes, using a superior strategy, and yes, they were better entrenched, but proved itself the equal on at least one day of the great forces of the most powerful military system in the world, namely Great Britain. So I think the whole New Orleans picture is, as Hugh points out, interesting, complicated, and worth revisiting.
Thank you, Hugh, for the call. At what point did Madison decide to send peace negotiators, and who were they, and why did he have a hard time? Some of them, I believe they had to be ratified, didn't they, by Congress? Had a hard time getting some of those people sent.
That's right. He began pretty early on to begin to negotiate or to attempt to negotiate. In fact, the Tsar of Russia said that he would be happy to mediate. The British ended up not agreeing to that mediation. But Madison nevertheless sent a number of men. Initially, the principal one was to be Albert Gallatin, his Secretary of Treasury, who was a very controversial figure in the Congress, and the Congress would not approve his appointment. He ended up going anyway. And in Europe, he was joined by several others, most notably John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams and subsequent president, of course. And they were the sort of two key figures on what ended up being a team of five negotiators who sat down with the British and, over a period of several months at the end of 1814, hashed out the Treaty of Ghent. Now, while we're talking about the treaty, it should also be said that the treaty really didn't address any of the principal points that Madison had insisted were the rationale for going to war. That is to say, in the treaty, there's a little Latin phrase called status quo antebellum that says basically nothing changes. So no territory changed hands. The treaty doesn't address impressment. It doesn't address the embargo or any of the trade issues. Basically, it just says, let's cease hostilities and go back to where we were before, which this continuing theme of why we've forgotten this war, that's one of the reasons, is that this treaty didn't resolve very much. It did return us to a status of peace and began us on a new turn in our history. But there it is.
Did it say, though, to Britain, that's it, we've had it with you?
No, it really didn't say that either, although, in effect, I think it made clear to the European powers, which was made even more rhetorically clear during the next administration, namely during the Monroe administration with the Monroe Doctrine, that it didn't make a lot of sense to come over here and mess with us.
Right.
I'm putting that colloquially, but I think that that was one of the significant accomplishments of the War of 1812, was it demonstrated that we weren't people that you could mess with in a way that they clearly thought they could and had done for the couple of decades between the Revolution and the War of 1812.
Mm-hmm. Boyd in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hello to your guests. Fascinating topic. I'm wondering if in your book you make a lot of references to General Winfield Scott. I'm curious to know more about the guy, and I want to eventually take time to read more on the War of 1812. What was interesting about him, how influential was he, first of all, and it was something that happened many, many years after the War of 1812, is that he, two things, he became an advisor, actually, to future President Abraham Lincoln during the war between the states. And an interesting note about him was, when it looked like there was going to be a war between the states, ironically, what was given to Robert E. Lee of heading the Union forces, but then Lee rejected and wanted to, because he identified himself as a Virginian, Winfield Scott was actually offered to the head of the forces of the Confederacy, but he declined the job and felt that it was more important to preserve the Union. Your thoughts?
To tell you the truth, I don't know in detail very much about what Winfield Scott did, but I think it's worth pointing out that he played a role in this. A number of other parties, a number of people who were subsequently presidents, named James Monroe, most obviously, John Quincy Adams. The War of 1812 was something of a training ground, both for military and political figures. The story about the Civil War interests me because I'm thinking about writing a book about the Civil War next.
Oh, you are? Great.
So, Boyd, you and I will have to do our homework and learn some more about Winfield Scott.
Well, thank you, Boyd, as always, for your call. Chris in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I've read that one of the reasons for the burning of the White House is for the retaliation of the burning of Fort Dover and private residences along the north coast of Lake Erie.
Usually the justification that is cited is that American forces in 1813 burned what was then called the city of York. We know it as Toronto today. They took the town. Speaking of significant American military heroes, Zebulon Pike led the assault and, in fact, was killed when a powder house exploded. But that's the rationale that the British used to justify the burning of Washington. Although it's very interesting because after Washington was burned, and perhaps after the British had begun to realize that maybe they'd overstepped the bounds of propriety, a letter appeared James Monroe's desk, a Secretary of State, from the commander of the British forces, saying that we did this because of what you did at York. But the letter was dated before the assault on Washington, but it arrived something like 10 or 12 days afterwards. So there's this kind of disconnect, and it seems rather illogical that that letter could have taken that long to arrive. So was it written after the fact as a justification? It's one of those unanswerable questions that undoubtedly the British would take one side and we would take the other. But it was the Battle of York that you're referring to, Chris, I think, and that that they cite as the justification.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call. Well, Hugh, I'm sorry our time is a little short, but we're in a pledge drive, and I'm happy to pledge your book and the War of 1812. Where else can you do that but public radio, right?
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for writing the book.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for your listeners, and thanks to you, Kathleen.
Hugh Howard, our guest, and the book is Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War, America's First Couple and the Second War of Independence. It has just been published, hot off the press. And for those of you who can give us a gift of $180, we're happy to send this to you with our thanks for being fans of history and for knowing so much more about history and keeping history alive as well. It's been said that we're a nation losing our history, and you can't lose your history, or how do you move forward with any kind of intelligence? So that's that story. Pledge, please, WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is our number. Rhonda Fanning joining me in our studios. Hey, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. We're looking for 30 more pledges in, say, the next 8 minutes. Well, you can pledge through the news, so we'll add another 6 minutes on top of that. Thank you for those who have already given this hour. If not, please help us stay on track by making your contribution right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I know you've been enjoying, because he was a wonderful guest, the conversation with Hugh Howard on Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War. Please take a few minutes to make this hour and many more history programs to come possible. Put a value on the program that you enjoy every day. Make your pledge, please, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you decide the amount of your pledge. Every pledge is appreciated, and every pledge helps pay for the programs that you love on WPR. So please consider asking for Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War as your thank you gift if you pledge this hour, 180 or more, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we are happy, actually, to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio, because we, in case you haven't been able to tell, enjoy what we do. We learn so much every single day. It's terrific. Maybe your gift is $50, $100, $500, $180 would be good for this particular hour, and we'll send you the book. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount, WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is the right amount, WPR.org or...
Many people make a contribution of $60 or $120, and that is fantastic. These are the gifts that add up to a large portion of our budget. But your gift of any amount is greatly appreciated. So please consider a gift of $1,200 if you can. It'll help others that can't give right now. Please make your gift of $1,200, $100 a month, right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Whether it's our superb news coverage of what's going on in the world and the country and in the state of Wisconsin, or a 60-minute talk show, you hear about the topics that affect your life. They really enrich your life, keep you informed about what's going on in all areas of life, and you hear about them on Wisconsin Public Radio. Listeners like you help pay for the quality of the programs you hear every day. Please give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're still looking for 29 more pledges in the next 5 minutes. Your pledge right now helps pay for the programs you count on. Thanks if you've already given. If not, give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We heard from a donor who said, I'm a better mom, a better sister, a better employee, a better person because of the WPR experience. Another said, WPR is as important to me as my morning coffee.
That's serious business.
Yeah, it is.
Because WPR makes you a better person, or it is an important daily ritual in your life, join your fellow listeners in supporting it. Your donations make WPR possible. At WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Please give now.
Remember, you can get Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War for your pledge of $180. It's a really good book, and it's a part of history that we probably all need to fill in the gaps that we have when it comes to that war. It's very, very well written, and so that's, I think it's a nice premium. I think it is. It is.
Supporting Wisconsin Public Radio right now is a great thing to do with 2 minutes of your time. Just give us your name, your contact information, how much you would like to give, and how you would like to pay. Whether you call or pledge online, we keep your personal information safe. We don't share it with any other organizations.
And your gift really supports all of the stories, all of the programs that keep you connected to the world and actually to each other. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Think of your contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio as an investment in your future. Give us 2 minutes of your time and your donation in any amount, and in return, you're going to get lots of great programs like this one.
Like this one, you're right. Like this one is tomorrow's and Mr. and Mrs. Madison, right. Think of your contribution really as an investment in shows that you will continue to hear, and you will. So pledge, donate, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. In just a couple minutes, you'll have made a wise investment that pays dividends every single day.
That's right. And be sure to ask for a copy of Mr. and Mrs. Madison's War with your pledge of $180 or more. Go online, WPR.org, or dial 888-202-2552.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. Somebody should do a movie about Dolly Madison and the burning of the White House. I think that would be really fascinating. I kept thinking in terms of possible movies. She was something.
I agree.
He was something, too. It's a really interesting book, and I think we should become better informed on big things in our history. This was a big thing for a lot of years, the War of 1812. So pledge now $180, and you'll know more. That's what we do. We teach. We want to know more. That's why we do what we do. We know more. Thank you, Rhonda, very much.
Thank you, Kathleen. And thanks to everyone who pledged.
Thanks to Rhonda Fanning. Thanks to Katie Madsen for helping out here today. And thanks for pledging. Until tomorrow.